Welcome to The Good Stuff with Sonoma County Wine Growers. I'm Virginie Boone alongside Carissa Cruz, President and CEO of The Wine Growers. We are here to talk about what makes Sonoma County such a special place to grow, make, and enjoy wine.
And dance to our opening music, too.
I just love it so much.
It makes me happy.
I think I have heard it a couple times just out in the wild, and I'm like, I'm so happy. I don't start talking, which is the good part.
That is a good part.
I don't automatically start saying, introducing
the people around you.
The good stuff. Not yet.
We're here with my friends today.
We're going to talk about, I don't know, something.
Oh my gosh.
So the big question today is, why are we never in some really cool places in the world at the same time?
That is a great question.
Outside of here.
Outside of here, which is cool.
Very cool.
And even cooler now that we have air conditioning in studio. So like literally cooler.
Yes.
I'm headed to Paris. You want to come?
I was just there.
Your plight in life is so hard.
Yes, I just couldn't be bothered to go again this quickly.
No, that's definitely
not true.
Taylor Swift is no longer going to be on that continent. Yeah, so you might want to stick around here.
Yeah.
Closer to home.
Yeah.
Maybe you should head to, you know, Kansas.
Well, okay, that stumped me for a second. I was thinking Miami, Indianapolis, or New Orleans, or Vancouver, or Toronto.
But she was going to invite you to hang out in the VIP box at Chiefs games from now on. So
you know, we don't need to get into this now, but I used to cover football and in my past career, and I spent a lot of time in locker rooms and press boxes.
Not friends
and family boxes.
Wow.
Very different.
No doubt. Was that good stuff or not good stuff?
Very good stuff. I was covering 49ers, which is always going to be good stuff. When Candlestick was still around. Oh, and boy, that place really needed to be blown up.
I did not know that. That's like a little hidden.
Did some Raiders stuff too. Much better experience.
Yeah.
Candlestick was not a great place to cover a game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Do you see? I'm kind of in shock right now.
All right. Yeah. Well, let's get back to talking about Paris.
Yeah. But back to me. No. So I'm off to Paris this week for work, but really exciting meetings. I think I've mentioned on air before that Sonoma County Wine Growers is a member of FIVS, which is the Global Wine Trade Association, which is a great organization. My counterparts from Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, all throughout Europe, the European Commission, Comité Vin, which represents the wine regions around Europe. And it's just a forum for thinking about literally global trade, the World Health Organization, and what is happening with wine around the world. And so, I mean, we are probably the smallest member in size and region. We've been members since 2015. They approached us after we announced our sustainability commitment to join because we were really on the leading edge of what was happening with sustainability in our vineyards, and they thought that would be an interesting intersection. So they invited me to speak, and then I stayed on as a member, and Wine Growers, our board, suggested and supported us joining them. So every year there's spring meetings in Brussels, sort of the heartbeat of the European Union. But in the fall, they sort of travel around. They came to Sonoma County a few years ago, which was great to host all of these global partners here in our backyard. But they've opted to go to Paris. So that is what I have to do. So it's 3 days of meetings. And really, so much of their focus is on the sort of the triple bottom line sustainability efforts and how it impacts global wine and global agriculture. So I always learn a lot, and it's just nice to be in a group of peers as we talk about all of the challenges and opportunities our industry faces. So,
do you feel like it's a resource you can tap during in between meetings?
Absolutely, and have done a lot. I know when we were just starting to think about ingredient labeling and what that would look like, because it was kind of going to be a part of the export business first. If you exported wine, I was able to quickly get a primer from sort of the head of FIVS in literally a couple hours to support a couple of the wineries that were asking about it. And it was just like, what's happening? Or, you know, as we think about the dietary guidelines here and sort of the role of wine or alcohol in general, to be able to go to our peers and say, what's happening around Europe? What's happening in Australia, New Zealand? Even the impacts of climate and sort of learning from all of those. So it is a fantastic network that includes all these wine regions and then some very large companies like Gallo and, mm-hmm. and others, Constellation, that have been members for years. So excellent resources.
Yeah. So there's other California representation. But
yeah. And the Wine Institute is a big partner. So it's great. Like I said, we're kind of small, but it's a great peer group. For sure. So, and you know, if I have to go to Paris, I'm just going to, I'm up for it. So.
Okay. Well, I hope a lot of champagne flows your way.
It will be delicious.
All right. We'll come back soon and introduce our guests on today's Good Stuff. Stuff. And Carissa, I don't know about you, but we've got some pretty cool guests today.
I was gonna say legends.
I know, legendary guests today. I'm a little nervous.
I know.
You know, we've got somebody who was named Professor Chardonnay at one point in his career. Mr. David Ramey, founder of Ramey Wine Cellars, and his son, Alan Ramey, who is now co-president of Ramey Wine Cellars. So we've got a 1-2 punch.
I know.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. Good
thank
to be
you.
Here.
Yeah, I mean, and in the thick of harvest, too. So we're feeling your, I don't know, anticipation, your excitement, your happiness, your dread, all of those.
Like, well, there's about 30 tons of grapes on the cellar floor right now.
Okay.
Both Chardonnay and Reds. So, yeah, we're right in the middle of it.
All right. Well, we better talk fast.
That I can do.
Yeah, okay. Let's go. Well, I mean, I don't know that you need an introduction, but maybe we do start at kind of the beginning of Ramey Wine Cellars.
Well, so I'm fortunate to have figured out that I wanted to make wine, and so it's the only thing I've done as a grown-up. So I had a degree in American Lit from UC Santa Cruz, and then I was a waiter for a year, and then I was living in Mexico, and I just had this epiphany. Why not make wine? And so I all but turned around and ended up going to UC Davis, getting a Master of Science in Enology. I finished that in 79. And then I was the only one of my class. There were a bunch of us in the late 70s, that liberal arts retreads that decided to become winemakers. So, yeah. I mean, Kathy Corson was there, Randall Graham, David Graves and Dick Ward of Saintsbury, John Konsgaard, Doug Nall here in Dry Creek Valley.
Amazing.
Heidi Peterson Barrett was a class behind us. Paul Hobbs was a class ahead of us. I don't know. We just all, it was the zeitgeist. It was a demographic blip. of all those that I just named, I was the only one that decided to go to France and work a harvest, because I thought those people had been developing these techniques to make wine over 1,000 years. Why not learn them and bring them to apply to California's spectacular fruit? We have, I think, maybe the best growing climate for fruit in the world. When you combine the fact that it basically almost it doesn't rain for 6 to 8 months of the year in the summer during the growing season, and then the coastal fog of the Pacific Ocean, so that it's just a spectacular climate. So I did that, but I started out as assistant winemaker to Zelma Long at CME, which was also unusual. Everybody else that I just named got full charge winemaking jobs right out of the gate, because the industry was so ascendant at that time. But I knew I didn't want a full charge job, because I knew I didn't know how to make wine. and so I wanted to learn from somebody who did. So I approached Selma, and she ended up hiring me at CME. So for almost 5 years, we did some really good work together at CME. And then I replaced Mary Edwards at Matanzas Creek for 5 years. And then back to France at Christian Wex's invitation in 89, Pomerol. And then Chalk Hill for 6 years. And your original question was at the beginning of Ramey Wine Cellars, when Christian then asked me to come leave Chalk Hill and come manage Dominus and get the building built. I said, but Christian, you don't make any white wine. He said, well, you want to make a little Chardonnay on the side, that's okay. And that was the beginning of Ramey Wine Cellars. Yeah. I knew Larry Hyde from having bought his Semillon to go into the Matanzas Creek Sauvignon Blanc. And he found me a little Chardonnay, and so we started, my wife Carl and I started Ramey Wine Cellars in 1996 with 260 cases of Hyde Vineyard Chardonnay.
It's like, you sort of told like the just incredibly important part of California winemaking history right there, right? I mean, with Zelma, what do you remember, like what did she teach you? Like, what do you really remember about your time with Zelma?
So what I learned from Zelma was the Mondavi scheme of production management. You get the grapes from the crush pad to the bottle with quality intact, you know, and there's specific operational steps that we still use to this day. Some of the forms, like the weekly work form, mm-hmm. I mean, Cameron Fry still uses that and fills it out in the exact same way. And the daily, and then you transfer it to the daily work, and you know. So, you know, plan your work your plan. So crazy. That's different than winemaking. Now, I changed some the way, you know, I made wine when I left to go to Matanzas, but not the production schema, not the production management method.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When would you say kind of the vineyard piece came into play for you? Like, did you always understand vineyards to be an essential part of winemaking, like maybe before some of your peers? Because of maybe your time in France, or?
Well, gee, you know, you can't eat a meal without food. I mean, it's just,
so true.
Some people don't seem to be aware of that, though. I don't know.
Yeah. But I mean, it was sort of it was an evolution in California to have those two work together. Or am I wrong about that? I could be wrong.
Well, you know, the big, in terms of viticulture, the big shift in my career here, the 45 years or so, it was the replanting because of phylloxera. And, you know, UC Davis had recommended AXR1, which is Aramon times Rupestris, which was half vinifera, and it turned out to be, after 20 years, it turned out that rootstock was susceptible to phylloxera, which is this root louse that eventually kills the wine and then kills the vine and then moves on. And so, you know, one interesting thing, I was at Andy Bechstoffer invited me to lunch once when I was working in Napa Valley at Rudd, he passed around a postcard that was Napa Valley during harvest. It was an aerial photograph from the 60s, and it was a sea of red leaves. I mean, literally, just everything was red, and that's leaf roll virus. White grapes can get leaf roll virus too, but the leaves don't, they just get curled and stay green and gnarly. Whereas red vineyards, if they got leaf roll, they got, you know, there's another one that called red blotch now that we have to watch out for. But so in the old days, if the, you know, the alcohols were all lower, they were like, you know, 12 and a half, 13, because if they could hit 23 and a half Brix, which is Brix's measure of sugar, then that was good because leaf roll, it clogs up the xylem and phloem. Mm. You know, the xylem and phloem are like the veins and arteries of the plant, and the water and the nutrients go up and down. But if they get clogged up, then the vine gets sick, just like we get sick if we have a virus or bacterial infection. And so that was the opportunity to replant with clean plant materials, which allowed much better varietal selection. Mm. You know, the French text, there's on the grape varieties, there's early ripening grape varieties, which would be Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. There's late ripening grape varieties, which would be Cabernet Sauvignon, Petit Verdot, and then medium ones, Syrah. And in the old days, people didn't know that. I mean, we started in the 70s. We had no history. People didn't know. And so that phylloxera-driven replant urgency really was a huge thing in giving California better grapes than it had. Healthy grapes, and plant the right variety in the right site with the right rootstock.
Yeah. And eager winemakers. I mean, you have, and then you come in with like this group of your generation of very curious, very schooled, very more experienced winemaking too that factor in, I would think.
Yeah, I think that's a change too. As part of this is probably in the old days, the grapes were more just a commodity, and you know, get as much yield as you can and get them off the vine. Of course, in those days, the wine pricing wasn't so good either, you know, so it was much more cheap wine, much more bulk wine. And with the increase in pricing, then quality becomes more important and you get better price and better quality. And that's been sort of the history of Sonoma and Napa and California coastal viticulture in general for the last 40 years.
Yeah. Incredible in our lifetimes thing to see.
Yeah. Well, and we have talk about in our lifetimes.
Right.
You have the next generation
working
with you.
Alan's sitting here listening to me blather on, but you know, it's not the first time.
I was going to say.
Won't be the last.
He knows you well.
Yeah, he's known you a long time.
So talk maybe a little bit, Alan, I mean, what's your role, and did you sort of grow up knowing you're going to be part of the business, or was a little bit like, I'm going to run away from this, and got called back?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, like a lot of kids, you run away for a little while, right? You have to. So yeah, I remember a time when I was 4, and I thought, oh, yeah, I'll be a winemaker like Daddy. And then, but then, you know, you go through high school, and you change in college, and you go at first. I went to the East Coast, then England, and you just get as far away as possible, and then you start realizing, oh, well, actually, this is pretty interesting.
My dad might have something figured out after all.
There's something pretty cool here. So then you start getting the interest of learning the process and the procedure and the winemaking, and you know, all of a sudden it's biology, it's chemistry, it's intellectual, it's interesting. It's not just a glass on the table. And I thought, oh well. Now I get it. Okay, so yeah, I came back pretty soon after.
What's it like, David, having your kids in the business with you?
Well, you know,
family business is so much fun, huh?
There's always a generational challenge. It's I think it's 3 years ago now that Carl and I ceded the vineyard and the Westside Farms, our vineyard on Westside Road, and then the winery business to Claire and Alan, so they own it now. I'm mostly retired. I do stuff like this. Carla's still working full time. She's going to do that for another year and a, I think it's a year and a half maybe. She says she wants to retire at 70. But
I think that's allowed.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you know, it's fair. So I mean, I had reached I'm 73. I had reached a point where I didn't have patience for details anymore, so I was happy to cede daily control to Claire and Alan. And then, and of course, we have an incredible team. Cameron Fries, our president of winemaking, he was our very first employee, 22 years now. Paul Smith, the cellar master, joined us in 06. Lydia Cummins, associate winemaker, joined us in 08. So we've got a really strong bench, a really, really good team, and they know the procedures, and so there's very little chance that anything is going to get screwed up, I would say.
By the next generation, perhaps. Alan, I'm curious, like, between you and Claire, like, how did you sort of figure out your strengths and weaknesses, or how you would kind of approach running this business together?
Talking constantly.
Yeah.
We came in with different ideas of what we might do, and then there's the reality of the business and the winery and what it needs. And I think that's what a family business is about: is you see an area that needs help, and you talk to each other and say, "Oh gosh, we'll do this, I'll do that," and you sort of figure it out organically. My dad's absolutely right; we've got an amazing team. So I think in many ways we're incredibly fortunate that we can, you know, in some ways the smartest thing we can do is putting faith in people, showing that you care and respect them, and letting them do what they do. And I think that's we're lucky to be in that situation. And so that's really helped us be successful. But there's always new things and new experiments, and you know, we're always pushing for the next thing too.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more. I'm learning a lot.
I had so many questions. But.
I know. Well, I was going to say, I know we have to take a quick break here in a minute, but I want to hear more how you've actually divided those tasks up, Alan, between you and your sister. Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, well, we're an odd winery in that, you know, we work on a lot of the same things too. I think there's this sort of old-fashioned mentality that siblings will fight and therefore put them in different areas so that they will not punch each other in the vineyard, the old Mondavi story, you know that. And luckily enough, Claire and I haven't punched each other.
That's good to hear.
And so what all this is a long way of saying is I think there's a lot of things where our offices are right next to each other, and we'll have areas and we just chat back and forth and say, what do you think on this? What do you think on that? Yeah. Can you edit this? Can you do that? What do we need in the cellar? What do we need here? Who do we talk to there? And it's very much more, I'd say we're much more collaborative than really, from what I understand of the business, most other kind of winery heads. But I think there's also, I think, misinformation for years. You know, business schools taught people that you've got to have one person at the top, one person organizations are the best. And no, in fact, there's research starting to come out that shared leadership, when it's done well, big caveat, but when you can find a good thing, it works well. So anyway, so I hope that answers your question a little bit.
I might chip in that Alan has an MBA from Cambridge in the UK. So when he starts talking about business studies, he's actually read those business studies.
Yeah, fair point.
I know.
Okay, quick break. We'll be right back on Good Stuff. We are back on The Good Stuff with David and Alan Ramey. And before we get too much more into our conversation, I did want to, you know, get your take on the role of, I mean, you've been a family business from the beginning with your wife, Carla, as well. So maybe give a shout out to what she's done and how you've sort of divided and conquered that aspect of the business as well.
Well, her standard line is that she does all the stuff that nobody else wants to do. Yeah, one of the things just is kind of aside to that I'm proud of is that we built Ramey Wine Cellars without partners or investors. And so Carl and I have always owned everything 50-50 until we ceded it to Claire and Alan. I was out sampling grapes, buying grapes, overseeing production, finding places to make wine, finding where we make wine now, and she was paying the bills, you know, and doing compliance, and there's just a whole bunch of administrative stuff that it takes to run any business, but particularly the wine industry, which is so highly regulated. And we are technically in all 50 states, and every state has their own alcoholic beverage department, and some of them are more well put together than others.
Yeah,
and
I can only imagine.
Carla deals with them, and so when she does retire, I think we're going to take some aspects of her job and give it to existing staff, but otherwise replace her with a really strong person. So anybody listening out there, you know, keep us in mind for a chief administrator role, CFO, you know, bill payer, bottle washer.
Very important. All of that. Yeah, very important, especially if you want to keep the business in your family and to pass it to the next generation.
But tip of the hat to Carla, you know, I mean, as basically as we grew the business, I grew the business. I mean, there was never a business plan. I just kept making more wine and selling it. And sometimes I'd come up with an idea like, oh, we're going to take over the Russian River Chardonnay program from Les Rudd. That suddenly goes from, you know, 1,500 cases to 7,500 cases. And she was there to say, yeah, okay, good, let's go. And that's, in retrospect, that's pretty amazing because she's not, and she grew up in Chicago. She's solid Midwestern. She's not inherently a rash person, but Yeah, she was my chief enabler in the growth of Ramey Wine Cellars.
I love it.
David, I'm just curious, because when you first started talking about the class of peers that you were sort of coming of age in this sort of new California winemaking world, a lot of those folks went over to Napa, but you are very, very established here in Sonoma County. Talk of just about how did you come to...
And it's your home.
Yeah.
I always liked Sonoma better than Napa. Now, let me say that when we got out at Davis in 79, there wasn't that much difference between Napa and Sonoma.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a chasm. Money has changed Napa Valley extraordinarily, both in terms of investment and in terms of tourism.
Right.
And I'm still so... And I worked over there for six
right.
years, 2 years at Domino's, 4 years at Rudd. Mm. But I just have always, I first shoveled grapes at Lambert Bridge Winery in Dry Creek in 1978. And I just always loved Sonoma County. And I've always lived here since I moved up to see me in 1980.
Mm. Well, we've always appreciated having you as a champion of the region. So, and you know, enjoy your wines a lot.
Yeah, and there's that, yeah. But let's talk a little bit about this Professor Chardonnay concept that, you know, Wine Spectator has given you that name. And, I mean, it really is. You have championed and highlighted Chardonnay, especially in Sonoma County, but certainly in Napa as well, for a long, long time. Was it something that you just loved early on, or is it intellectually interesting? Like, what is it about Chardonnay and your winemaking that work?
It's kind of, I don't know, chance, happenstance. Mm-hmm. I mean, we still make Cabernet and Merlot and Pinot Noir and Syrah, and I've made red wine, you know, a lot of red wine at Simi, at Matanzas yeah. Creek, at Chalk Hill. However, of those that I just named, the Chardonnay was the biggest product, biggest projection, And then I have contributed a little bit. I mean, I have two published papers, and one of them was the effects of skin contact temperature on Chardonnay juice and wine. And so that led the industry away from doing skin contact. And then I pioneered whole cluster pressing, what the French call méthode champenois. So now you go around and you see on presses all around Napa and Sonoma and Central and South Coast too, hoppers, stainless steel hoppers directly on top of the press to facilitate dumping whole clusters of grapes into the press. And you do that to minimize the tannin. People weren't thinking about tannin in white wine, but all the color in white wine comes from the tannin from the skins, really, a little bit from the oak. And when I started, everybody was doing overnight skin contact without temperature control, mm-hmm. and extract all these tannins, and then those tannins would oxidize in the bottle in about 4 years, and you'd end up dumping them down the drain. So one of the keys to longevity of improvements in California Chardonnay is whole cluster pressing. And then mm-hmm. there was the brown juice thing that Selma and I kind of heard about. There was a German researcher, Müller Späth, who wrote three papers on it in the 70s. We got those papers and did the experiment, shared it with the Sonoma County Wine Tech Group, and now most people, not all, sometimes the next generation has to reinvent the wheel for themselves, but most people...
That's true in every business.
Most people no longer add SO2 to keep the juice green, and then so that then the tannins oxidize. This polyphenol oxidase enzyme, same thing as an apple. Cut an apple, leave it on your counter, watch it turn brown, but that's the tannins turning brown, and then they drop out on the yeast cells. So again, you have a wine with lower tannin. It's silkier and more delicate on the palate, and it has longer shelf life.
Okay, I think Professor Chardonnay is fair.
I was like, yeah. I feel like I just took a very great class on Chardonnay, so thank you for that.
And I know that, I mean, you've also been a big champion of Sonoma County Cabernet and some of the appellations that are starting to push some really high quality Cabernet here. Like,
it pains me that the world has decided that Napa Valley Cabernet is the ne plus ultra, because the warmer spots in Sonoma County, notably Alexander Valley, Knights Valley, the middle part of Sonoma Valley, make Cabernet that is every bit as good, if not better, than Napa Valley.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. And it just pains me that the herd mentality about Napa Valley Cabernet. These days, I have to say, sometimes some of the cabs over there are almost caricatures of there's tricks that are being used that they're not, you know, the wines are almost too smooth and plush in certain ways. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. I think that's a perfect time to take a break, and we can talk off air about that when we come back on The Good Stuff. Back on The Good Stuff. And you know, Alan, I was joking over the break that I was going to ask you now, like, well, okay, your dad mentioned this Napa Valley Sonoma County
conundrum
misunderstanding, you know, lack of awareness sometimes. How are you going to fix it?
I think the obvious answer is by drinking more. I joke a little bit, but I think blind tastings are always a great way to go forward, and we know something about that, because in our Chardonnay world, we're used to doing blind tastings of our Chardonnay versus Burgundian Chardonnays that are four times the price, and people blind taste it, and they go, oh gosh, well, they're pretty similar in quality. So, I mean, we're used to that game, and I think, A, you can do that with Sonoma and Napa, but B, I think the more interesting thing is break them all up even further. Look at all the neighborhoods. Look at, you know, on the Napa side, Oakville versus Yountville, and, you know, Alexander, Up Valley and Low Valley. I think you look at all the little pockets, and that's much more interesting to just go sub-region by sub-region and get into the specificity. And I think the more you educate people about those hills and where the fog comes in and where the soils are, I think you make as someone who appreciates those little neighborhoods and what Sonoma and Napa both do.
I appreciate that answer, because I thought they were just going to turn to me and be like, I don't know, Krista, what are you going to do to solve that? You're well, running an association that promotes the region, fair. Right?
I think that was implied, Krista.
I like that.
But, I mean, when you talk about that, I mean, obviously that's very important with the trade. That's very important with potentially, you know, retail, restaurants, media, critics. Do you do that with consumers as well, as much as you can?
You know, we probably should be doing it more. It's, you know, when you go out in the and talk to a wine dinner, the topic comes up. And so practically, you know, it's hard to buy a $400 bottle of Cabernet for a blind tasting every night. So it's realistically not as often done. But I think you can make the point. And you know what? Most people, the reason they have their opinions is because they just haven't, they're busy people with busy lives and they haven't gotten around to it. Yeah. And once you just tell them and explain a couple facts, they go, oh my gosh, well, that makes a lot of sense. And so I do think it is just getting out there and talking to people, just, you know, doing
and
the campaign.
And sharing the wines so they can try it for themselves.
Yeah, I think people taste and realize,
Yeah, absolutely. So talk a little bit about the consumer experience then at Ramey. How can people come visit you? What can they experience?
So we're a little old fashioned in that we don't have a very, you know, fancy bejeweled, you know, cube in the air to float around and taste. You taste at the winery. So you walk in and you walk upstairs and you can see the entire cellar floor and what's going on. So in the harvest right now, it's always fun because you can see some action. And so you get a pretty honest take on wine. And if you're lucky, you can pick some grapes and taste them too. And so I think that, you know, I think for most people, that honest way of tasting wine is compelling. And so for anybody who likes that and who likes the craft, who likes to be a part of it, who likes to see it, I think that's interesting. And I think there's a lot of people who come and say, well, gosh, I was pleasantly surprised.
The tasting experience is a bit formal, really. I mean, it's a sit-down tasting. There might be 7-8 wines. it's hosted. There could just be two people. There could be eight people. We charge a moderate amount, $50, but we have two hosts that generally host. One is a WSET 4, so he's on his way to being an MW, and the other has a Bachelor of Science in Enology from Davis. So they're both very knowledgeable. Guests typically spend about 90 minutes being educated about Ramey wine cellars and the wine. So it's the opposite of some of the wineries have vineyard views and lounges, and people just come almost like wine bars. Mm-hmm. They sit around, and this is not. It's an educational mm-hmm. experience.
Are you saying you don't have a DJ?
Disco ball. Yeah, are you? So Ramey was actually one of my very first wine tastings I ever did in Sonoma County before I moved here.
Wow.
Brett Raven did it.
Oh, yeah.
So I was at the facility, and it was very much that. We sat up kind of in the boardroom and looked over the facility and pretty much fell in love with your Chardonnay and your Syrah. And have been consistent fans since, so thought I would throw that little nugget out there.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Brett Thank was our you. Cellar master for a good number of years, yeah. and now he retired to... his vineyard and label, Raven Wines in yeah. Bennett Valley.
Amazing. Yeah. I can't yep. believe it. We have to take another break.
Sounds good.
All right. Are wrapping things up here on The Good Stuff, another great show with our guests David and Alan Ramey. So Tuesday Night Wine, let's get to it.
I know. Well, mine is a given because I do this a lot. I am, as I was saying, one of my first winery visits was to Ramey, and I have been a huge fan of the Richie, well, all their Chardonnays, but I really, really love the Richie Chardonnay, and I've gotten to drink some past library wines, mainly when we ask for them to pour for Psalms and you don't realize that I'm pouring myself the big glass and then they get the tasting.
Yeah.
But, you know. So there you go.
Okay. Well, I'll follow up with a Ramey Rocchioli because
delicious.
Always holds a special place in my heart. It's one of the very few wines in my critical career I ever gave 100 points to, mm-hmm. and I still love it. It's still in my brain yeah. and in my heart. So Ramey Rocchioli.
There you go. Mm-hmm. All right.
So, yeah, and just on both of those wines, when the single vineyard Chardonnays, they spend 20 months on lees in barrel. So it's yeah. the old-fashioned way. Mm. Complafond still does that. Cochelis still does that. But all our single vineyards are long time on east lees. My wine, I'm going to say Syrah. Now, it could be a number of different Syrahs, but I just love Syrah. Syrah is underappreciated by the general
street.
Public,
we
partly because the Aussies called it Shiraz, so people are confused. And also that cool climate Syrah, which is much of Sonoma County, certainly ours, is a savory variety. It's not a fruity variety.
Yep.
And so people are used to fruity wines. Syrah may take a little bit of education, but it goes sometimes Syrah, which is cool climate Syrah, is very much like Pinot Noir. Sometimes it's like it's Pinot Noir with flavor.
All right.
All right, Alan,
top
that.
Five.
Yeah, there you go. Follow that.
Well, I'll choose. I think on Tuesday night you're allowed to have more than one bottle of
Absolutely.
Wine.
Absolutely.
Is
yeah,
my firm belief. And so shout out to some friends, the Kanzlers, who I think make some great Pinot and Chard, and I think popping one of those is great. And then of ours, I think Westside Farms Chard, our own estate. We've been working really hard for the last 10 years to build that up. We're doing big replants right now, so we're excited about that, and so it means something to us. So that's another one I'd pull.
And I'm going to add one more. Recently, after in the post-Parker years, I've come to appreciate Zinfandel. Now that we're back at maybe 14.8 alcohol instead of 16.2, and Dry Creek Zinfandel, Russian River Valley Zinfandel, Alexander Valley Zinfandel, I love it. I drink it out of a tumbler. It doesn't need to be fancy. Do you know? It's just wine to go with your dinner.
I think we're going to have an epic Tuesday night.
I think so.
With all of these wines.
And you should just mention, go to RameyWine.com for their website. That's how you get to them. And Ramey, if you don't know, RameyWine.com. There you go.
Singular.
Singular. Yeah. Wine. I got it. Wine.
All right. Thank you for joining us. So thanks to both of you for joining us today on The Good Stuff. And from Sonoma County to wherever you are, remember to drink the good stuff.
Cheers to that.